For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, Alyssa Suave tells me about her debut novel, Ginger and Me. Actor turned author Ross Armstrong takes red sail to a luxury private island in his murderous new thriller, The Getaway. And I ask a whole babble of narrators just why they read for RNIB. All that and more on today's Read On. Ginger and Me is the debut novel from the winner of the Prima d'Or Prize in 2019, Scottish writer Alyssa Suave. Part mystery, part coming-of-age novel, it's been described as full of charm, insight and wit, and by turns funny, dark and heartbreaking. We'll hear from its author, Alyssa Suave, in a moment, but first let's hear from the audio version read by Charlie Moody.
It's hard to imagine this now, but there was a life before Ginger and Diane. After Mum died, the most important person in my life was my support worker, so I probably need to talk about her first because, in a way, she brought us all together. Apart from work, and I didn't really count the people on my bus as friends, except maybe the regulars, my support worker was sometimes the only person I spoke to all week. I really liked her. Her name was Sanvi, and she always wore a sari, a different colour every time she came. My favourite was the red and gold one. It sparkled when the sun caught it, and she'd hoist it over her arm as she walked so she wouldn't get the hem dirty. Sometimes, when she was speaking, I found myself staring at the blood-red spot in the centre of her forehead, mesmerised by it so that I wasn't really listening to what she was telling me at all.
It's about two young Scottish women called Wendy and Ginger. Wendy is 19 and she's a bus driver. And at the start of the book, her mum dies. She finds herself sort of alone in the world. Her support worker says to her that she has to get out there and make connections. So she does. She joins a local writers group. And she also meets her first ever best friend, who is Ginger. She appears just suddenly one day in the bus. They're both outsiders, I would say. So they quickly click and they become really good friends. But we soon find out that there's darkness underneath the good times. I would say it's partly a coming-of-age tale. So Ginger is Wendy's first ever friend, and we see them doing all the things that friends do together, putting on makeup, going on nights out, just really spending time together.
They kept asking me why I was outside her house that day and who was with me. I tried to say I would never harm Diane. I loved her. And I mean I loved her. Not just the writing. Though I do love her writing too.
The book's also partly a mystery. So it opens with Wendy in prison. Right away we're thinking, oh, you know, what's happened? Why is she there? And there's also mystery surrounding Ginger's home life that you know, unfurls just as the book progresses. So I think it's fair to say it's quite dark themes in the book, but also lots of humour, mostly around Wendy's sort of very innocent way of looking at the world and the way she often misinterprets things. Most importantly, there's a relationship that she thinks she has with a local author called Diane, but we, you know, the reader, we can see that doesn't actually exist, or certainly not in the way that Wendy thinks it does.
One of the things I tried to tell the police was, I'm a writer like Diane. That's what we've got in common. But they wouldn't listen. They arrested me, told me anything I said would be admissible in court, even though I loved Diane. I can't speak for Ginger. I can only tell you what I told them. I never hurt Diane. That didn't stop them putting me in a police car and taking me to Motherwell Police Station, practically via the same route as the 240, which was not my favourite route to drive at the best of times. I don't know where they took Ginger.
we're sort of jumping into the story really quickly. You know, we know that, you know, she's in prison. My goodness, something bad has happened. The rest of the book is then going back to a year previously. This is how they met and this is what happened. And we do find out why she's in prison.
Wendy has problems defining sarcasm and things like that. Is she slightly on the autistic spectrum?
Interestingly, I've seen quite a few reviews where people have described her as either neurodiverse, Asperger's, autism. It wasn't my intention to make her specifically any one of those things, but I appreciate that a lot of her traits, she has traits in common with autistic individuals, as people who have Asperger's, but it's never specifically stated in the book. And I wouldn't want to specifically state it either, because I don't feel that I have enough experience and knowledge of those things to speak authoritatively on them and say, you know, this is how an autistic person would react. This is how a person with Asperger's would react. But I'm aware that people who do know more about these things than me, they are identifying those traits in Wendy's character.
I didn't go to work or eat or even take a bath for weeks after she died. I was finding it really hard to know what I was doing all those things for when Mum and me weren't going to Tunnocks for our tea, or into town window shopping at the posh shops, or even just talking over dinner about what had happened on my bus that day. With Mum gone, I didn't think anyone would notice or care if life caved in on me, and I just stopped being part of it all.
I think that Wendy's experience, I think it is quite a common one. Most of her issues, I think, stem from that she doesn't really have a sense of community. You know, she doesn't have people around her to help her with things, to help her manage things. And I think, you know, most people could identify with that at some point in their lives, certainly. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why you might find yourself with no friends. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person or there's anything wrong with you. So hopefully people will identify with that and will empathise with Wendy.
Is Diane Weston based on anyone?
Not really, but I think a lot of the positions that she espouses in relation to publishing and, you know, who gets to be published and what happens when you're published, I think they're quite common.
And there's some nods to the Scottish writing scene in there.
Oh, yeah, because obviously that's, you know, that is, as we're going to come on and talk about later, books of my life. Obviously, I'm, you know, impacted by books that are written in Scotland and by Scottish authors. And you know, I'm very proud to be a Scottish author, and I feel like a Scottish author.
At first, it felt strange going into Tunnocks from a steak pie, because me and Mum used to go there together every Thursday. We'd have a cup of tea and a scone in the cafe at the back, and then pick up a large pie the ladies behind the counter would have all packaged and ready for us on the way out. Mum would ask the woman handing over the pie about her daughter, who'd gone to university, and check with the woman at the till how her uncle, who'd had a stroke, was doing. And she'd been at school with the manageress, so they used to joke about not getting any younger and how old age doesn't come alone. She always knew the right thing to say and made it easy for me to hang back and say nothing, which was what we were both used to.
A clip of Charlie Moody reading the audio version of Ginger and Me. What did you think of our reading?
I've read reviews and I'm just so delighted, because people have said things like Charlie Moody really captures Wendy's wide-eyed optimism. And, you know, given that the voice of Wendy and her character is just so crucial to the book, the fact that Charlie Moody has captured that's just great for me as an author to hear. I'm really delighted about it.
Did you have any influence on the narrator?
Can I tell you, when I first heard her voice, I was slightly concerned, because I thought she sounded quite posh. And as you can probably hear from my voice, and I'm from the same sort of area as Wendy and Ginger, I'm not posh at all, and they're not posh at all. And I was slightly worried about that. But of course, Charlie Moody is an actress, and she changes her voice and the way she acts for each particular part. And as I can tell from the reviews, she's clearly done it brilliantly. So that's all I know as a writer, and I should just shut up when it comes to, you know, who does the audio.
Now, some authors research their books in the south of France and in tropical places. Were you riding the 255 bus around Uddingston as research?
I'll tell you what I did do, and it was an absolute joy. I went to Tunnocks very, very regularly. If you know that Wendy's absolute favourite snack is a Tunnocks tea cake, and actually, on a more serious note, Tunnocks does play quite a big role in Wendy's life, because she and her mum, before her mum died, her mum and she used to go there and, you know, have chats there. Her mum used to try and help her, give her advice in the Tunnocks cafe. So yeah, that was about as far as I got. No, I have for years ridden buses around View Park, Birkinshaw, Belsill anyway, so I didn't especially have to do it to research the book.
Now, you won the Prima Donna Prize. Tell us about the Prima Donna Prize. First of all, what is it?
The Prima Donna Prize is a fantastic initiative that's been set up by a group of women who are all, you know, hugely successful women in their own right, and they don't need to do this. I mean, I'm sure it's an absolute hassle for them to set up a festival and a prize, but the reason they've done it is to give opportunities for women who, for various reasons, may not otherwise be able to access the literary world, the publishing world. There's an annual festival, and then there's a prize. So there's a theme of the prize every year. The year that I won, the theme was Prima Donna, which I thought was a great theme, because there's so many different ways of interpreting that, isn't there? You know, you could, Prima Donna can be somebody who's fantastic, a fantastic woman, or it can also be, and this was the way I took it, oh, you know, don't be such a prima donna, don't be such a drama queen.
And you got an agent at the end of it.
Yeah, so part of the prize was agency representation from Catherine Summerhays, who's part of Curtis Brown. Now, I mean, you're part of the writing world yourself, you'll know it, but for me, somebody from Uddingston, I mean, there's just no way, I can't imagine how I could possibly have had access to somebody like Kath Summerhays, you know, a London-based agent for my debut novel, had it not been, you know, for the Prima Donna Prize. So I do think that it's hitting the mark in the sense of, you know, increasing access to people other than just your, can I say, London middle-class writers who have access anyway.
And what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Really, I want readers to have empathy with Wendy and Ginger. Wendy and Ginger are two young working class lassies. They're born with no privilege, none of life's advantages, but yet they're resilient, they're optimistic. They do really the best that they can do with the hand that they've been dealt. And I really want readers who, I think a lot of people who read this book will not know women like Wendy and Ginger, will have no concept of women like Wendy and Ginger. And for them in particular, I want them to say, God, you know, people like Wendy and Ginger, yeah, their dreams are different. Their dreams are, you know, they're not dreaming about going to university and, you know, having a great career. But still, they're entitled to their dreams and their ambitions, and they're every bit as valid as anybody else's.
I can't go to prison. What about my house? My job? Oh, my passengers would miss me. They'd wonder where I was. Wendy, he said, frowning. I'm not sure you realise just how much trouble you're in. These are extremely serious charges. But it's a misunderstanding, I said. Look, Diane and I are both writers. We've got a long history together. Ask her. She'll tell you. He shook his head and told me he'd see me in Polmont sometime during the week. And that was it.
Ginger and Me by Alyssa Suave is available now in print and audio, and will be coming soon to the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Alyssa, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Alyssa will be back at the end of today's show with the books of our life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Last week was former presenter Red Sale's last show in the presenting chair. But as we promised last week, you certainly haven't heard the last of them.
Ross Armstrong is a classically trained actor who has appeared on stage in the West End, on Broadway, and in a slew of top TV dramas, including Foyle's War, DCI Banks, and most recently, Ripper Street. All of which has been a great training ground for his burgeoning career as a best-selling thriller writer. His latest novel, The Getaway, is set on a private island where death lurks for a dwindling cast of characters. Ross joined me from his home in London to set the scene.
The pressure cooker atmosphere is very much in play in The Getaway. So on the Greek island of Korpios, the billionaire Robert Rathwell decamps with his entourage, including his 9-year-old son, who's quite a good deal younger than him, given he's in his 80s, with a tutor, his lifestyle assistant, who's a kind of a expanded PA, and his wife, much younger, Sophia Rathwell, and his head of security. And they're all there because they're suspecting that something is brewing in terms of a super injunction ending of Robert's, which is about to reveal something quite terrible for him back in London. And he thinks he should be as far away from that as possible. Little does he know, when he gets to Korpios, there are just as treacherous things waiting for him on that private island. And it's not long before there's a murder on the island.
Yes, his problems have only just begun when he steps onto the island. And even in his 80s, he is an uncompromising and particularly bilious character. He's a media mogul, and I wondered what had inspired the idea of him.
I mean, I think there are several sort of characters in the popular public imagination that just have, you know, we could point to stuff like Succession, and partly thought of this as Succession meets And Then There Were None. So sort of if people are familiar with the characters from that world, then they'll be familiar with Robert Rathwell to some extent. But also, you know, in the real world, we have examples of people in all walks of life, actually, to be fair, at all ages and in all types of careers. I mean, mostly now we've got Silicon Valley or post-Silicon Valley people who've gone power mad. There are some of them in the news even this week. You don't have to be an English or Australian newspaper mogul to be cut from the same cloth as a Robert Rathwell, to have problems with paranoia in terms of who around you is trying to bring you down, possibly. And also to have that, like you say, bile that comes from somewhere, probably as part of why he became so successful, but also might be his downfall as well.
And that bile is toxic to those around him. The story is told from the point of view of three women in his party: Isabel, as you say, his lifestyle coach and fixer. Sophia, his Nordic second wife, also known as TW2, Trophy Wife 2, which I very much enjoyed. And Amelia, the super tutor to his son. And all of them have been tainted by his unpleasantness, or maybe actually drawn into his orbit, because they too are also faulty people.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something I love about, in terms of like the world of likability of characters you hear a lot these days in literature and in fiction of all kinds. I mean, I like a flawed, sometimes craven character, and we've got all sorts here to enjoy on that spectrum. And, you know, some of them, they all have their sort of various faults. They've got their various peccadilloes and extremities. And we get to hear a lot of the inner voices of at least these three women who are surrounded by him. And they've also got much to recommend them, I think. There's a lot of winningness in these people who've worked hard to keep their own sense of their own orbit while being in the orbit of someone like Robert Rathwell. I was quite interested in how, what sort of people surround themselves with a man like that, how that affects them, and indeed what's, as you pointed out, faulty about them that's led them there, but also what are the good aspects that might help them, I mean, in this case, literally survive this situation. They say Mensa's full of people who wanted to be in Mensa, so that's the sort of people we were dealing with there. They have an interest in intellect, an interest in problem solving, and perhaps being deemed intelligent, but of course, in any scenario, you've got people who have self-selected to be in that scenario. So, as you quite rightly say, we've got people who have found themselves with Robert Rathwell, and we learn more throughout the book about what's led them there and how that will condition their future.
And it's a fantastic narrative device to have as well, because being flawed people with a killer on the loose in the background, we are just waiting for the next one to get stabbed, like Midsummer Murders.
Exactly, yeah. interesting. I was saying, talking about a book I really love, which is set in the LA riots. And again, I was describing that as a particularly violent endgame episode, a sort of red wedding of Midsommar Murders. Everything rises or falls to the condition of Midsommar Murders, I think. But yeah, I think as soon as you, in something that might be deemed a locked room, or some people don't like the term locked room, you can get in trouble saying that these days, but a pseudo sort of locked room thriller, there is that who's next quality to every single moment. And that really allows you, particularly with the three voices I've used, to flip between those three people, while feeling at the same time who is responsible, but also who's next. And that gives you a lot of space to sort of twist and turn the narrative on its head and take all the expectations you have one chapter and completely upend them by a different perspective in the next chapter.
Now, as we've said, there are three voices telling this story. They're all female characters, and in the hands of a lesser narrator than Susie Riddell, there could be some risk of them all blending a little bit together in the listener's head. But Susie's got a terrific ear for dialogue, and she does a brilliant job of distinguishing, particularly between the accents. She does a wonderful Danish accent for Sophia, the second wife.
It's brilliant, and she's done a terrific job. I was so pleased when I heard her audition for it and heard her do the vinyl book, because it is so important. There's so many different things to bear in mind when you're reading a book. I mean, I'm an actor as well, and I can't claim to have mastered the art of audiobooks. It's difficult to, because I think in some senses a lot of people are looking for different things. I mean, I'm very interested in everything from the book being acted a little but not acted too much, the pace of how people read. I've heard audiobooks when the first line I hear, name of character walks into the room and sees other name of character, closes the door behind them and sees other name of character, and I'm lost completely, because there's something about the tenor and the quality of the voice, or something about how that line works with how it's read, is just difficult for me to hear and then process. So someone like Susie has clearly got that gift for being able to do that with pace, where they would put the world into your imagination. But also, as you say, that really important thing with this is find three women who are aged 20 to 40 and not find the voices falling together too much. Obviously, I've helped her out with some accents, but some would say I haven't helped her, given her some problems there. But those voices had to be distinguishable from each other. So I've got to thank Susie for a fantastic work on the audiobook and really honing those qualities and giving each character absolutely their own sense of who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure she wouldn't say, but I can imagine it might have been a little intimidating to take this gig, since your first novel was narrated brilliantly by your wife, Catherine Stedman, who is also a rather fine actress. And then you took up the reins for your second novel, Headcase, and narrated that.
Yeah, that's right. So it was quite a surreal thing when I thought, oh yeah, of course Catherine's not going to do this and I can't do this, that would be ridiculous. So it's an amazing thing where like three brilliant voices who are all sort of up for the role of the getaway appear, and they were sent over by my publisher onto my phone, like, oh god, all of these are brilliant. But just, you know, in particular Susie had that quality of, well, she's really got it. And it's come to this point where me and my wife have moved on to other people reading our books for various reasons. You know, sometimes someone's just better for the character than us, and it's amazing to hear these voices, because there's something about it where you just go, oh yeah, that's the one. It seems to be so instant that you can just tell what you need for each story. And that's not to say the other people who send in extracts as well, you go, oh wow, that's also fantastic, but you know when you've got the right one for the right job, and it's quite interesting to be on the other side of that process.
I look for sensory pleasure in everything. The dark winters of a childhood in the Danish countryside make you grateful for every piece of light you get. The problem for Robert was his successes. He had had so many that he had built up a resistance to joy. "Do you need anything?" I said to Robert. "Anything at all?" "Car," he croaked, his head bowed. The question I always asked about my husband was which version I was going to get. The one I love above all things. Some others, I love parts of. But there are a couple of sides to him I have to watch very carefully. However, even in his kindlier moods, he never let standards slip. That is why he always asked for spring water from the Norwegian islands of Lofoten wherever he went. It's the hardest to come by, and when people provide it for him, it shows he has retained his worth.
Susie Riddell narrating The Getaway, written by my guest, Ross Armstrong.
Now, Ross, as I said in the introduction, you are very well known to those of us who love to go to the theatre and also who like a good thriller on TV. Working on things such as Foyle's War or DCI Banks or more recently Ripper Street, has that informed the way that you write your novels? Because often, especially things like DCI Banks, are screenplays adapted from much longer novels and concertinaed into 2 or 3 one-hour long episodes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what I've learned from both being in and watching, and I suppose I'd say my consumption of all sorts of different crime drama probably is of a piece of the acting in it. I think the writing occupies a completely different sphere. But in terms of the watching and the being in it, you get a sense, because I've been the victim, I've been the red herring. I won't say, geez, for people who haven't seen episodes of things, I've been in, whether I'm the killer. But one thing about doing that that does actually, even as I think about it, enhance the writing is that actors come up with way too many thoughts about their own character. So whoever I am, part big or small in a crime thriller, I'm thinking, why is he there? When did he last go to the toilet? What are in his pockets? I've got all these questions I've written down, which they, the sort of thing they tell you to do at RADA. And then from that, you could write a whole essay on the character's day. And that kind of, I suppose, sort of far too much information quality I have does help you to develop characters of your own. And of course, when you're playing a scene on TV, you're aware that actually you've got to get in late and you've got to get out early, and your character is subservient to what the viewer needs in that moment to excite them, thrill them or move them. Then you've got to do not too much and not too little to achieve that. And so you end up taking that quality into scenes that you write in your work. And I've certainly thought about that a little bit with every book I write.
Yeah, my wife and I are both great lovers of whodunits, and quite often during the commercial breaks we'll be sitting there going, why wasn't that character in any of the last scenes? What were they doing? And I think you take quite a similar approach to the way you write your books. It's actually what's happening off stage.
Yeah, there is a bit of that. I have a habit of either writing, well, often I can write sort of real time or close to real time. Like, well, I need to actually have an absolute awareness of where that character would be then. Because when you collapse the timescale and something like The Getaway to a few days, every moment and hour counts. And if you've got a hole in your imagination, your geography and timescale of where everyone is, then you're in trouble. So I guess they probably can end up reading like that, because I mean, I'm just too interested in where people are going to be during the ad break. But as an actor, I can promise you, we all know, we've all got a reason, we've all got a place they are as soon as we go off screen. Almost 100% of the time, we know where we're going and what our character's doing next.
And when you were growing up and in between the weighty tomes that you were doubtless reading for your English degree, what were you reading for fun?
There's a huge gap in my reading life, really. I mean, I really was an avid reader way too young. I was reading Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, lots of Douglas Adams books, precociously young, like 9 or something like that. And then I fell in love with The Video Shop, and so I avidly consumed movies. And then I think I fell back in love with books around the time of my degree, and I started reacquainting myself with probably what were the sort of literary commercial classics at the time, which were like Life of Pi and Ishiguro. I really liked The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford in terms of my degree. That's a great classic book, a great romance told from the point of view of the cuckold. And I loved that character. It seemed very theatrical that you had a very characterful voice. And similarly, in Ishiguro's books, there's often a similar sense of characterful voice. So there's a lot of his books which are sort of also got into for fun, which have this stately, very atmospheric quality, but also very, very readable. And that's what got me back into reading and from the clutches of Quentin Tarantino.
And if I could offer you any book to narrate as an audiobook, which one would you push all the other narrators out of the way to get hold of?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I mean, I do like my friend Chris Whitaker's books. He's a fantastic writer. His last book was a real classic, I think. So, but they're all very American. So, like, can I persuade Chris Whitaker and team that I'm the man for that book? I don't know. But we begin at the end. Chris is what? That's a real corker. And I, outside of crime, I suppose, I really like Jennifer Egan, who's written books like A Visit from the Goon Squad and Manhattan Beach. Again, though, American, can I convince them I'm the man? Maybe, maybe. She's got a lot of different voices in her books often, so I should be good for at least one of them, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm pretty convinced that Susie Riddell is Danish now. So yes.
That's the magic of drama. We can get there. That's what you can do with your voice. So who knows?
Now, in the credits at the end of the book, you thank a nameless airline employee for saving this book. Could you just share that story with us?
No one should ever do what I did and not back up your novel. That's the most important thing. Never, ever do that. But I was in a bizarre situation of being caught between changing my method of how I backed up my documents. And I got on a plane to Greece and partly thinking about this book, quite a few drafts in. And mid-air, the Thomas Cook airline went out of commission. So by the time I landed, my bag in particular, my laptop was taken out of my hands because that thing where there wasn't room in the plane. So they grabbed the bag off me, didn't have time to put a tag on it, and then sent it somewhere. And by the time I hit the ground, it was very clear that everyone's bags who were taken off the plane had been lost. They could be anywhere in the world. So the machinations and the weird twists and turns are really far-reaching in terms of how I got it back. Suffice to say, it involved being given a series of numbers which were not the correct number, me almost starting to dial numbers at random to try and find out who I could get in touch with in different areas of the luggage system in the UK, and ending up being led through a secret door in Heathrow Airport, and a chap on his first day finding my bag from my description out of literally like 300 bags piled up in one enormous like hangar. And you know, it's him I have to thank, because otherwise that book was absolutely lost. So it feels incredible that it's out in the world now.
Sometimes the best stories are true rather than fictitious. Ross Armstrong, thank you so much for taking us into the dark and threatening world of The Getaway and for being a guest on the show today.
Red, thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks to the generous support of HarperCollins, The Getaway joins Ross Armstrong's other thrillers in the RNIB library.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
The RNIB Talking Book Service is absolutely free, giving you access to over 34,000 fiction and non-fiction books for adults and children. The service simply wouldn't exist without our wonderful narrators. So, at a noisy gathering, I talked to a whole babel of Talking Books narrators and asked them why they kept coming back.
I think that the biggest thing is in what we've seen, many letters come back from people, especially the one I like is I tend to do a lot of books that younger people might like. You've got I've done for teenage books and early 20s, that sort of thing. And as a person who is a voracious reader,
Christopher Ragland.
There's a lot of those books that I would read normally, and I kind of like the idea of people who would be like me but can't do that, to be able to, for them to get to read the books like I was able to do. So I just think that's quite cool.
Oh, from a selfish point of view, I love the stories. I love reading the stories. I love telling stories. Some of the books I've read, I would never have read on my own.
Stephanie Beattie.
It's a discovery thing, and you lose yourself in it. There's nothing like a book for losing yourself. Your imagination comes alive, you envisage it. And I know I listen to a lot of audiobooks myself at home and plays on the radio and things like that. And to just sit and just let your mind do the work rather than your eyes do the work and immerse yourself in somebody else's world, it's magic, just magic.
I narrate for RNIB because I am myself visually impaired.
Narrator Giles Abbott.
ever since my voice broke, which is too long ago to remember, people have been saying to me I should narrate or I should, and also I've been making my living since 2000 by, I'm a professional storyteller. And so when I came down to London, I thought, I've got to do this. And I went for, I applied, and Rupert asked me to come along for an interview, and I came along for the interview, and then Rupert saw the white stick. He said, oh, you didn't mention the white stick. I thought, I didn't think that would be necessary. And he said, ah, it shouldn't be, but kind of is. I said, well, I've read books to my wife on my Nokia communicator. Do you remember those? They were the hot thing a few years back, and now nobody remembers them. I read something off very large print, big pieces of paper for Rupert, and he said, you're an amazing narrator. Let's give it a go. And so we tried with paper, but it was too much flapping because I had to change a piece of paper every two or three paragraphs. I'm using 20-point font or larger. Just too much rustling. And so we tried from my mobile phone, which meant I spent... It was a Will Self novel, and I think it took 7 or 8 days, from which I was spending six hours of every day with my eyes crossed, which, nothing wrong with that. It's a natural physiological phenomenon. We did it. It was a bit slow, but since the iPad's been invented, that's much easier. And actually, I'm going at professional speeds. Well, for me, the iPad means I can read books again for the first time in 13 years. My sight went wonky in 1998. I've lost all the central vision in both eyes. Looks like macular degeneration, but it's actually a symptom of multiple sclerosis. Optic neuritis is the medical name for it. And so, with the iPad, I can make the lettering much bigger, and I can just turn pages like anybody would. And the best thing is, when you're using CCTV, your eyes have to stay still and the text moves, which means I get motion sickness after half an hour. With this, I'm reading the same way I always did. My eyes move and the text stays still. And I can mark it up and it works.
I'm at a very noisy gathering of talking books narrators, and I'm asking them why they read for RNIB. Next up, Christopher Oxford.
I think it's partly because one's giving something back. RNIB has been very helpful to me in giving me regular sessions at a microphone. And when I started out in the audio business, I wasn't really very experienced, obviously. And the professional standards and the competence of the engineers who work at RNIB was very helpful to me in developing a technique that I could then apply to recording audiobooks with other studios. And I've always found that anyone at RNIB on the production side is extremely helpful to a novice narrator. And now, of course, I've got 10 years under my belt, and I feel that I'm one of the old hands who can pass something on to the new generation.
I've had some feedback over the years which is very touching.
Heyward Morse.
Friends who've said, oh, I just noticed that my elderly grandmother is listening to one of your books, and I think what you're doing is a wonderful thing, and all. Well, I wish I was that, you know, heroic. It isn't. It's as much to keep myself ticking over as it is to do something for the RNIB. It's a perk that you're doing something worthwhile to me.
There is a genuine love and camaraderie among the people who work at the RNIB that make all of the readers feel very special.
Narrator Eric Myers.
We all know that together, the engineer on one side of the glass and the actor on the other, putting those books together for all the people who are listening, that it's an extraordinarily worthwhile and fulfilling job to do. It doesn't pay a whole lot, but we're not there for the money. We do it because it's all about the love of doing good work, reading terrific books for people who really want to hear them.
Well, I've been reading for the RNIB now for nearly 30 years.
John Chancellor.
I have to say that of all the work I've done as an actor, I would say that reading at the RNIB has been one of the most fulfilling and wonderful experiences. I read for the RNIB because it exercises my artistic abilities, but it also has a charitable element to it, in that I love the idea that what I'm doing is helping somebody to be able to access literature And I think that that's a wonderful and very privileged thing to be asked to do.
Well, one of the reasons is that I get to read books that probably I might never have read unless I was actually reading them for the RNIB.
Di Langford.
I really enjoy reading for the RNIB. I've been doing it for about 30 years. I began because they needed somebody who could do a Welsh accent. I was born in Cardiff. I don't speak Welsh, but I can do a Welsh accent when I have to. So every so often, I'll be asked to do a Welsh character in a book. But most of the books that I do are RP, that's received pronunciation, and then every so often, we commit in a character with another accent. I really enjoy reading for the RNIB. Because of doing it, I've also become an audio describer, because the RNIB began to describe films on video. And since then, that's moved on, and now audio description is available in theatre, and we do it for opera and also for architecture. So the RNIB has set me off on a completely different tangent, and I'm now able to describe for people who are visually impaired, and that is a real pleasure.
It's just on two levels, it's a wonderful thing. I love reading books, and I love the fact of the RNIB. I think it's a brilliant institution, is a terrible word, but I think it's a wonderful and worthy idea.
Frances Jeter.
And I know people who listen to these books and really, really love them, so it gives me great pleasure to do them.
Every time you get a new book, it's a new experience, even if it's one by an author you've recorded something else by.
Narrator Richard Burnley.
And I think the other thing is that you know that it can reach anybody in a way that, you know, a piece of theatre perhaps can't. And that when you're working on it, you're in direct contact with a piece of work, and you get to work on it with a sort of, I suppose, an intensity, and you get really quite close to it in a way that you don't always get to do as an actor. There's a couple of reasons, anyway.
It's really important to me that I feel as I'm doing something really, really useful. Enabling other people to enjoy reading as much as I love it.
Sherry Beans.
On a selfish note, it's because I get to play every single part. Parts that as an actress I would never get to play. You get all the best parts, parts that you would dream of playing, and you're in your own little world creating this world within the book for our listeners. So that's why I love it.
I narrate for RNIB because I enjoy it, and I hope, you know, those who listen to them will enjoy it as well.
Philip Rillerton.
I do it because I've always been intrigued with it. Ever since I was a child, reading out loud has been important to me, and as an actor it's important to me, and I feel that if I can convey something, you know, it's giving an actor an opportunity to do something that they're very rarely asked to do in a play, which is to play every single character. Sometimes it's even a female. You think, I'd love to be able to do that. How would you do that? In a talking book, you can play everybody, and that's fascinating and it's fun, and you hope you can also, you know, convey that to the people who are reading it.
Well, there are many reasons. I really enjoy reading books out loud and getting into the nitty-gritty of what's going on in the story and how best to convey that to the readers.
Ali Lindsay McClure.
And also because it's for a very good cause. I like reading to people who are hopefully going to really enjoy listening.
To join RNIB Talking Books, email helpline@rnib.org.uk or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now on Read On, it's back to Alyssa Soavi for the books of our life. Alyssa Soavi is the author of Ginger and Me, as we heard at the start of today's show. Now, Alyssa, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Oh, you know, I'm going to cheat a wee bit here because I was a great reader all through childhood. But there's nothing really about sort of stands out at me, you know, or having some real great impact on me. And then I didn't really read at all until my mid to late teens. So the book that I've chosen that made me start reading again was James Kelman's A Disaffection. It's set in Glasgow. It's about a teacher who's disaffected by his profession and by life, really. There's a scene in my own novel, Ginger and Me, where Wendy reads a book by Diane that's set in Glasgow. And she says something like, oh, you know, I didn't know you could write about places like this, you know, about ordinary people like me. And I think, you know, that's exactly how I felt when I read A Disaffection. It's about just an ordinary person going to places that I can recognise with problems that I can relate to. So I think that's really, really important. And I think, you know, this was written in the 1980s. I think we forget sometimes the contribution that Kelman made to Scottish literature by his, you know, absolute insistence on writing about whatever he wanted and in the language that he wanted to write. So, you know, books that are popular today, like, you know, The Young Team or Trainspotting, I mean, I just don't think that they would exist without Kelman. So, yeah, I think it's just a hugely important book for me personally, but also generally in literature.
What is it she teaches? Norman asked. History, replied Alison. That's the lassie with the blonde hair. Yes, said Alison. Any special period? I think it's the First World War. No kidding ye, said Patrick. Sometimes I used to go staggering home, miraculous drunk from such nights. Can you imagine it? Unbelievable getting drunk and bored like that at the same time. For God's sake, it's almost like a logical contradiction. I mean, you wouldn't think it was possible. He swung the wheel too abruptly and apologised once the corner had been turned. That's me gabbing too much instead of trying to concentrate on the road. Used to talk. But neither did. Okay, said Pat. Alison said, is that it definite, then? You're not going? Nah, I used to go. I'll still drive yous, but... Another silence. It was obviously difficult for them. Perhaps especially so for Norman, because he didn't really know Pat. So this sort of carry-on must have been a mystery. He was probably thinking along the lines of, is this the true state of affairs? Or is it all a ploy to get rid of me so as he can be alone with Alison? And the guy couldn't be blamed for thinking that. It was partly true anyway. In fact, Patrick had gone in a huff from that moment he eased off the handbrake back when leaving the pub. Its cause could be traced directly to Norman, who should have had the gumption to appreciate Patrick was wanting to be on his tod with Alison. He was a brother man. Brother men should appreciate such things. They do appreciate such things. They just sometimes are obliged to shove a spoke into your wheel. Sour grapes or something.
A Disaffection by James Kelman is read by Joe Dunlop. It's available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you go back to again and again on a rainy day?
Well, there is, and you know, when I thought about this, I thought that question suggests a book that makes you so happy that you want to reread it. But the book that I reread quite often, in fact, is not particularly happy at all. I would say even it's quite melancholic. It's The Temporary by Rachel Cusk. So it's about a young woman who navigates life as a temporary office worker in London. And what Cusk does so brilliantly is that she captures this idea of you're an outsider. You want to become part of some social circle, but, you know, you don't really belong. Your background, your education, your class, I suppose, you know, it's just different to the circle that you want to become part of. And I think it's really sad that these things matter at all, you know, that you can be excluded on, you know, you didn't go to the right school or whatever it may be. And I think, a bit like Kelman, I think that, you know, this was written in the mid-90s. So even though we're used to, you know, women writing now from a female perspective about London middle-class experience, I think at the time it was less common. So Cusk, you know, I think she also deserves respect for breaking new ground.
In a call box on Fortune Green Road, where Hampstead ends and Kilburn begins, a telephone was ringing. Francine Snaith heard it, and being possessed of the conviction that destiny had it continually in mind at any moment to summon her, felt it was intended that she should answer. It had begun to ring just as she reached the top of the road, its call clear above the humming, dusky swarm of the pavement, and its imperative grew louder as she made her way alongside the throbbing traffic towards it. Several people walked quickly past the call box, shaking their heads as if angered by its unsupervision, but one or two had stopped and were watching it with interest. The compelling pulse was loud in her ears as she reached the scene, and she felt herself drawn by it out of the crowd. In the glances this action drew, she saw the natural acceptance of her distinction, and the busy pavement seemed to part before her. She opened the door, releasing its clamour into the street. Once alone inside the shrilling enclosure, Francine was wrapped in warm air, oily with urine and cigarettes, the manifestations of an anxiety she had often witnessed as she walked to and from the bus stop, but to date had never shared. For the grooves of her daily routine, though rigid, at least ensured her safe passage past the brutalized individuals always to be glimpsed here, desperately shoving scrabbled coins into the hungry slit, while, from their downturned mouths, Francine could occasionally hear snatches of a dark bureaucracy. "Just one night. I'll pay you back." "But you said you sent the check." And, most often, "What am I supposed to do?" Her revulsion at these creatures was tempered by the safety of her distance from their misfortunes, and her confidence that the divide which separated them was fortified by sheer impossibility even permitted her to tend a small patch of pity for them. When she picked it up, the receiver was tepid and greasy with use. "Hello?" "Oh, yes. Hello," said a man's voice with an impatient sigh. "Can I help you?"
Available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library, that's Antonia Beamish reading The Temporary by Rachel Cusk. And finally, is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently is fresh in the mind and you'd like to recommend.
Indulge me for a minute, because there was two that I almost chose before I made my actual one. The first was Hourglass by Kieran Goddard. He's also a debut writer. He's a poet and his prose is just absolutely beautiful. I mean, it really is lovely. The second one, and you might have read this yourself, The Void by Ryan O'Connor. It's not unlike Kelman's. His character is a disaffected young man. He lives a sort of a shadowy life in an abandoned block of flats. That is also absolutely brilliant. But the book that I really want to recommend to listeners is called The Change by Kirsten Miller. I'm cheating a wee bit because I haven't finished it yet, but I can already tell you, you do not want to miss this book. It's a thriller. It's set in Long Island, featuring, wait for this, three menopausal women whose midlife crisis gives them superpowers. I mean, it is just so entertaining. The women's voices are electric. It's funny, it's really, really fast-paced, and you just don't know what's going to happen next. It's out in August, and I really highly recommend it.
No one had seen the woman who lived at 256 Woodland Drive since early November. Now it was late April, and the house looked abandoned. A modern masterpiece, set back from the road and surrounded by gardens, it had once been the neighborhood's biggest attraction. Real estate brokers ferrying clients contemplating a move to the suburbs had gone out of their way to drive past it. Now the gardens had grown wild, and a gutter dangled from the roof. The children across the street speculated that the owner, like so many unfortunate old ladies before her, had probably been eaten by cats. Their mother assured them that couldn't have happened, as she cast a worried look at the family pet. The owner's name was Harriet Osborne, and though she wasn't new to the neighborhood, few people on Woodland Drive could claim to know her. For over a decade, She and her husband had left for work early each morning, and if they returned, it was late at night. The two would vanish completely for days at a time, but while they were gone, the house rarely seemed empty. Twice a week, at 9 on the dot, a small army of cleaners and gardeners descended on the property. The curtains on the tall street-facing windows were yanked open, and the house's interior was revealed to all. Cars passing by often slowed or pulled over. The house developed a significant social media following after influencers christened it a monument to good taste. When the Osbournes were profiled in the country's most prestigious shelter magazine, newsstand sales spiked in the vicinity of Mattock, New York. The couple had no children or dogs that would have forced them to engage with the community, and no desire to mingle with their neighbors at any of the coastal town's seafood-themed festivals. So the residents of Mattock made do with what little they could glean from the article. Chase Osbourne was the chief creative officer at a Manhattan advertising agency best known for a long-running campaign that featured a family of talking pigs. Harriet Osbourne ran a rival company's new business department. They both appeared to be well-preserved specimens in their mid to late 40s. Chase had a tattoo on his neck and wore his blue suit without socks. Harriet's chunky black glasses framed intelligent eyes, and her matte red lipstick drew attention to a subtle smirk. When the attractive pair weren't off traveling the world, they split their time between their house in Mattock and an equally stunning penthouse in Williamsburg. The Osbournes, the author of the article More Than Implied, were leading the kind of life readers should have been living.
The Change by Kirsten Miller, as read by January Lavoie. It will be available commercially soon. And Ginger and Me by Alyssa Suave is available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. And Alyssa, once again, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me. I really enjoyed talking books with you.
That's it for today's show. I'll be back at the same time next week with more book news, reviews, and author interviews. And remember, you can join me every day of the week on Talking Books. First at 7 in the morning, then there's a different tale on at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. I can be found on Twitter at talking_books. So farewell until next week, and remember to read on.